husband would introduce the likes of Tony Forder to my great friend, Mr. Ozu, who was a Nigerian who'd married a white woman and was going through all the horrors of rearing bastard children.
Mm.
Yes. And you can imagine, they were both anthropologists, one in a practicing sense and one in a theoretical sense. And it grieves me so much that the department now is staffed by anthropologists who see no connection.
Yes.
But it makes me realise what a great man my husband was, that this house became a powerhouse for research, which was rooted in what was in those days, the police told me, the worst ward in the country.
Yes.
And I think that's what gave that whole Grove Street series, yes, Crown Street series, its real flavour.
Can you remember any more stories of these two worlds suddenly finding themselves face to face?
Well, it happened a lot down in Wales, because my father had bought us a little valley and put up wooden huts during the First War, so that we could get away for holiday and that.
Yes.
And we lent one of these huts to the university settlement, the men's settlement.
Yes.
And my husband, because of his being a professor, was made chairman of the settlement.
Yes.
And looking round for somebody imaginative, he found a schoolmaster who was in dire disgrace because he was a failure, called John Mays. And he appointed John Mays against everybody's advice and encouraged him to examine the neighbourhood, which is Ship Street, Marion Kerr, and which is where Janet McCrindle and McAdam and that did their girls' club training. It was a whole complex of activity down by the docks there. He encouraged John Mays to eye the neighbourhood and to eye delinquency with his capacity as a quite considerable poet.
Yes.
And offered him the hut. We went to Wales most weekends because otherwise too many homeless people arrived and the house went like a fair. Because there were no relieving officers in those days, and I was the only person around, so we used to have to go away at weekends. We went down to this hut, and the Nile Street boys were brought down by John Mays. John and his wife would select John's club. I don't know if you've read Growing Up in the City and all that. The classics about delinquency. And John was evolving the theory of the subculture in those days. And the club at that point was only for delinquents. And at night John would take his jeep and tour the streets. And the bargain with the parents was, I will take your boy if you will give me authority to scoop him up. And he would chase them round the streets and say, you've got to come to the club, you promised you would.
Yes.
And he scooped them up in the car and brought them to the club, nearly all of them on probation or just out of Borstal or somewhere. And he would hand-pick them, five or six at a time, and bring them to Wales. And so they sat in one hut, and he would tell us that so-and-so, well-known local families, great big black boys, and he's up on a murder charge, quite literally, and that's one of the Redmond family who every Orange Day is in court for street fighting, 19 arrested at a time, in these streets around here.
Really?
And they would be sitting in one hut, and we and our local Welsh village friends, the man was the caretaker for the place, would sit in the other hut. And these were miners, Welsh miners, who lived out in the Mould area. And the Welsh miners would talk to the Liverpool delinquents. And the Welsh miners, without realising it, taught them morality, which they've never encountered as bastards, as half-castes. And the astonishment of each side, again, the surprise. And I realise, talking to you, that emerges as my theme, doesn't it? My surprise at what I saw. And I think to this day, if people knew what the police-public relationship was like, they would be astonished too.
Yes. Yes.
And John Mays was able to put it down, and the opening of Growing Up in the City, they wrote in this room.
Yes.
My husband said, you begin by conjuring up the scene, the smoke from the ships on the river and so on. Mm-hmm. And so they drafted out the opening in this very room.
Yes.
And it was that Welsh morality, because these Welsh miners are very highly supersensitive people, like all that Welsh talent for sensitivity.
Mm.
And they would say to my husband, you want to watch that lad? He's not straight, he's not got his feet on the ground.
Mm.
And to some other lad who was in deep trouble, they'd say, that's a very splendid young man. And they, of course, didn't know the delinquent background.
Yes, yes, yes.
And the Welsh farmers to this day would say to us, whatever happened to that big Negro you used to bring? You hate to say, well, he's now in prison for life or something.
Yes.
But they remember them as such fine young people and how delightful they were and how they loved to meet them. And I think that was a calculated technique of my husband's, that you put Welsh sensibility together with amorality, I think is the word, of the delinquents.
Yes. Can I ask you this? How did you explain your choice to your social work friends when you came back from the West Indies? I mean, presumably you were still in touch with Janet McCrindle, Dorothy King, Josephine Duckworth.
Oh, that generation were all right, because they'd been reared as suffragettes.
Yes, so they weren't surprised.
No, and they knew that the ultimate, that's why we wanted to vote, was that you could get political action.
Yes.
But by that time, I was very disillusioned with things like the settlement. That was why my husband got John Mays in, to get rid of the paternalism on which the thing was running.
Yes.
And being me, I don't recollect it, but being me, I'm quite sure I said to them all, oh, damn, just patronising whatnots.
Yes.
And politics is the answer.
Mm-hmm.
I think they would be, my recollection is they were taken aback.
Yes.
But it was a calculated decision. Again, by that time, you see, we were much more mature. We didn't just go for things blindly.
Yes.
And it was because a woman in court, a white woman, had begged for a chance for her lads, because her husband had gone back to Ghana to try and set up a home for them so that they could leave Liverpool, because she said, there is no life for boys like mine in Liverpool.
Mm.
And I was so ashamed. I came home and said to my husband, I really had to go into politics. I couldn't sit around running boys' clubs. It wasn't the answer. And he volunteered that he had decided against making any bid to be a vice chancellor, for which he was then, he was ripe.
Yes.
And he knew if I stood as a Labour politician, that would put paid to it.
Yes, yes.
And we agreed that was the line we would forward. And therefore, he then developed this whole series of research reports, which studied all the group work and the movement of the population from Speak out, from Crown Street out to Kirby and Skemmersdale and all that.
Yes.
And the whole of that was his, that was his way forward, instead of going off into administration to be a Vice Chancellor.
Well, how did you get your...
That would bring us up to about the 90s, where I said farewell voluntary work. But then you see the story changes, and as I work my way through politics, I come back to the original respect for the individual citizen, which is the point I'm now at. So I'm really back where I started.
Yes. How did you get your connection with FSU then? How is it that Fred made it?
That was my husband's connection, because the man, Eric Mackay, was the assistant registrar at the university, and my husband had an eye for hidden talent. That's how he found John Mays.
Yes.
And he observed this man, and they must have, somehow, he must have known that Mackay was doing this work. I think students probably were parked out with FSU.
Mm-hmm.
And he became real blood brothers with Eric, who was a remarkably fine man. Oh, a lovely man. And totally underused by the university because he wasn't a gentleman. And so he was kept as deputy. He was never invited to dinner parties or anything.
Mm.
And it was because of my husband he wrote the book that he did write.
Yes.
And because of my husband he published it. Otherwise they would never have published it. They tried hard to suppress it.
So which book was that?
Eric Mackay's book, what's it, I've forgotten what it's called now, but about FSU.
Is it,
I have it, I could lend you it.
Yes, I'd be very interested to see that.
It's not a very great work, but an honest endeavour to tell a story.
Yes, yes.
And Mackay was a Quaker.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of them were.
Yes, and a man of very great principle. And so I'm quite sure that he revived in me that respect for the individual.
Yes, yes. I wonder if I mean, you mentioned all these famous people, and I wonder whether there's any. I can sort of provoke any more memories of them from you than those you've already given me. You've mentioned Eleanor Rathbone, Dorothy Keeling, Elizabeth.
With these academics like Titmuss and all that, most of them were very cordial towards me. But there must have been, maybe my husband never asked the ones who weren't. If they weren't value-based, we didn't want to know them very much. But I remember people like Forder and Titmuss as being very interested in the effort the pair of us were making to link academic research as a basis to political policy.
Yes, yes.
But we were each defeated. I remember Margaret Mead coming because she was rollicking through, I forget which marriage, but anyway, some relationship or other, and she quite clearly wanted my husband, and she was very much annoyed to find I'd got a grip on him. It's just an attempt to conceal it.
Yes, yes.
But what she produced, she was very sharp-tongued. Did you ever meet her?
No,
very sharp indeed.
Film on her intention.
Yeah, and she said what was the matter with me was that I was minority-minded, that I was so marred, just as people in America, if you're southern state, I suppose you meant a chip on the shoulder, and that I, as a Scot, was agin the English and agin men and everything. And it was very discerning of her. She was quite right.
Yes.
And the pair of us had never realised that there was a real culture clash in an English, rather upper class Englishman, marrying a Glaswegian. There was a real culture clash. I was always grateful to her for it, but I never liked her. But that was illuminating because the ward, well, because. Increasingly important to me, and how you ever fed academic ideas into the political system.
Yes.
And, oh, I've been completely defeated on that one. I think the gulf is wider than it was then. In those days, City Council would ask the university, would you examine, speak, and tell us what we've done that was wrong? Whereas now, if you say university, they burst out guffaws of laughter. And if I go to the university and ask for help, as I've done with these anthropologists, they say they can't see any connection. And there was far more hope placed on the relationship in those days than there is now. That we've lost out on that terribly.
Yes. Yes, the relationship between the university and the council, the community.
And I think the trend through it, looking back, was that we worked through the stage of how you set up Beveridge and how you, the different stages of the labour exchanges, and it got to the dole and public assistance and all the changes of name and what they meant. We worked through all that mechanical stuff and it took a great deal of talk, and whether you had advisory committees for public assistance or whether they were no good, the public had nothing to contribute, and so on. But then, slowly, the other theme began to come out and I think took over to our great detriment, which was that you needed to defend the individual against this vast machinery. And all I can see now, what ended up in this great rights movement, all that began to emerge. That the state was too big and you couldn't cope as an individual. And how were you to get your rights? And if a blind man had rights, then a man with one leg had rights. And if he had rights, and yet at the end of the day, the bill would be such you wouldn't be able to pay it. I remember Gertrude Williams coming out with a book or article or something which said that if we filled all the existing vacant posts, there would be nobody left on the streets to do any other work at all. We'd so overdone the state service line.
Would you agree, though, that nevertheless it all starts with the state, because it's the state that confers these rights in the first place that one has to assert?
No, I think what we lost sight of...
A person's only got rights because the right state has said...
But what we
received it.
Totally lost sight of was Beveridge's third volume, about which I'm slightly crackers. It's a rotten book, but the theme is the sound one, in which he said you may implement volume one and two to whatever extent you like, but unless you implement volume three, it will be as naught, and we are a doomed civilization. And volume three was the input of the citizen, that it mustn't be one way. It's not doles from the state to the individual, but also the state has the right to serve, the individual has the right to serve the state. And we totally lost that one. And that's the political lesson that I've learned, which brings me full circle back to the importance of voluntary. But it's a totally different concept from the Victorian one. It is the citizen's right to give to the state. And that's where I've now got to with things like the Preschool Organisations Committee, which is the only one of its kind in the country, where preschool playgroup leaders, mums, have a right to be part of the state machinery. And I think this is a completely new concept. And so I like to think of it as a spiral. Maybe I'm back at the same point, but further on.
Yes, right. Yes, I see. All those criticisms I mentioned before we started recording that Barbara Whitten and others made of social workers during this period, I wonder what your view of all that was. That they were overly concerned with individual motivation to the exclusion of social circumstances?
Oh, totally with her. I don't remember the detail of it now. Mm-hmm. But this was where my husband valued my political input, that you had to think about the community, and that was what Carl Saunders had come to Liverpool to teach, that the unit of survival is the community.
Yes.
And all the work that the group had done on, my husband's group had done on Speke and Kirby, and that was the message all the time. It's not the individual. Mm. It's the individual in society. Mm. And that was the time when casework had gone all value-free and all this non-involvement and everything. Mm. And many, many of my husband's young people, staff and research students left because they couldn't go along with him. And he insisted that if you had anything to do with the social sciences, you were inevitably involved. You could not do pure research.
Yes.
And he and Titmus, of course, were close allies.
Yes.
And very hard times those were, because many, many people had gone overboard for value-free sociology.
Yes.
And my husband was very much scorned and laughed at, along with Titmus and the rest. Mm.
I think it all came full circle again, though.
Yes. But I like to think, not just full circle.
Yes.
This spiral, I hope it's an upward spiral, certainly I'm much further on than I was.
Mm.
But I hope you will, I've got this for you, that stuff. Yeah.
Yes.
That of Eleanor Rathbone's, that was what I think you'd call the seminal period, and it was in Liverpool it all happened, around about 1902.
Yes.
This discovery of perpetual motion that kept her going all her life. She was working at the minute when her final stroke happened. She was still at it, because I think she discovered the basic principles of social work.
Yes, I read her Mary Stocks biography on a while ago.
Well, it's Mary Stocks wasn't a very sensitive person. She was witty and shrewd, but not sensitive, and I was after something more fundamental. Mary says it better.
Yes.
But I was after the real essence of Eleanor.
Yes.
And I think, I like to think, if you read between the lines, I got further than Mary Stocks did.
Yes,
Perhaps because I didn't know her so well, and therefore it was easier from the outside. Have you not read my Eleanor Rathbone lecture?
No, I haven't read, no.
No, the Eleanor Rathbone lecture.
No,
oh,
which is...
I've got that upstairs.
Yes.
And Eric Mackay.
Yes.
Right. Now, what about that? Is that not enough?
Well, what about the question you don't want to answer about the thing you look back at with greatest pride?
Undoubtedly. You put it that way, that's easier. It wasn't an episode, you see. Undoubtedly, the fact that I look back at myself as the girl of 18 who arrived in Liverpool. And I am not the same woman. I have travelled. And whether I've travelled as far as I ought to have or anything, quite irrelevant. But I know I have moved, and I know I am still learning.
Yes.
And I think that's my achievement.
Yes. Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah. Still, still humble, I hope, still aware of how much more to learn. And therefore, for that reason, I think, not backward looking, able to be the age I am and still be moving forward, because there's still so much to learn.
Yes.
And I think to have arrived at a principle, I don't offer it as a remedy for the whole world, but for me, it's the principle that makes life worth living, makes me get up every day, is the value of the individual. And as long as I'm not shut up by myself, I think I would die in prison. But as long as there is one other person for me to value, then my life's got meaning. And that's very embedded now, and I like to think that will take me through, and when I'm semi-senile in an old home, I shall look at all the other semi-seniles and it will still be worth living because they're there. I don't know whether that's Christianity or what it is, but it's me, and I've arrived at that one.
It's very nice.
Yeah. And I think that people like Barbara Wooten are unhappy because they haven't found a principle that takes them through their sad days and their difficult days. I don't say I live up to mine, but you know, it's there and I can come back to it. So, you pick what you can out of that one.
Well, thank you.